Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that just can't make up its mind. My name is Corey Hazelhurst and my emotional support peacock is Steve Haynes.
Still not sure how I feel about that, but hello.
Well, it's obviously based on the story this week that a woman was not allowed to bring her peacock onto a flight in America, even though she offered to pay a ticket for the bird. I tell you who is probably in need of an emotional support peacock, Steve.
Who's that?
And that's Theresa May.
Makes sense.
It's not been a good week, has it really, for our beleaguered Prime Minister.
Has she ever had a good week as Prime Minister?
She had it, well, when she was 20 points ahead in the polls, it was a good week.
Yeah.
The last good week was in December. The budget was delivered by Philip Hammond with reasonable accolades. And then after that, they sorted out the Irish border situation. That's not a problem anymore. And the EU gave the assent to pass the first round of Brexit talks.
It all seems so long ago.
Really does, doesn't it? Now, obviously, if you haven't been paying attention to the news this week, listeners, don't worry. Nothing new has happened. Theresa May still won't spell out what she thinks about Brexit. She still won't sack ministers for gross incompetence. This week it was Steve Baker for misleading the House over economic forecasts. Also never happened before. She sparked a completely unnecessary and counterproductive row with the EU over something she can't win. In this case, it's over the rights that EU citizens will have over the transition. And if there's anything that we've seen about the EU negotiating so far in this kind of Brexit process, it is that they will look after EU citizens. So nothing has changed, not for the first time. So it's a government completely directionless, it's out of ideas, it's lacking in leadership. That's not just me saying it, it's Nicholas Soames saying it, it's Tory MP saying it privately, and in public, it's Cabinet Minister saying it privately as well. Which begs the question, why have Britain had so many governments like this recently? Not just singling out the UK for this, because obviously there's France famously has had lots of governments who haven't been able to solve a lot of the entrenched and cut through a lot of the paralysis which is evident in the French government. Italy also famously, lots of governments don't tend to get a lot done. Germany as well obviously hasn't got a government. So this isn't just something that is peculiar to Britain, but what we've had, Steve, over the last 25 years is we've had an administration under John Major, we had the administration under Gordon Brown, and we've got this one. And they're three governments which do seem quite similar in that they are categorised by a directionless approach and also weak leadership stemming from the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's I think the UK is quite an interesting case study in this kind of failure to, in terms of like having governments which just haven't been very effective. Simply because when you look at some of the other countries which have been afflicted by this, such as Italy, they all seem to have they've got proportional representation in their parliament. An awful lot of their weakness and inability to govern comes from the results of the elections themselves. Whilst Major lost his majority over the years, but did have one, and even won a surprise, won an election which everybody thought he was going to lose. Brown had a majority. Granted, it wasn't as impressive as Blair's the time.
But it was still 65, yeah. I think, 66 in 2005, so it was a big majority.
Yeah, it was a solid majority, and Theresa May did have a majority, managed to bungle that up.
What happened to that majority?
I think she lost it after she called an unnecessary general election and started listening to Nick Timothy on policy advice. It is very interesting that we do have these three governments and that all have suffered from the same things. And I think in the British context, it's not necessarily about the political system or anything, but it's just the fact that all of these governments have come after a long stream of success in one form or another. Well, all of Major, Brown and May, in effect, initially inherited their administrations. Major obviously winning, becoming leader after Margaret Thatcher was kicked out. Gordon Brown becoming Prime Minister after Tony Blair stood down. Theresa May becoming Prime Minister after winning the Tory leadership after David Cameron steps down after the Brexit referendum result. The fact that all three of these leaders have inherited their governments and have gone on to have difficulties and be a bit rudderless and directionless, I think is probably quite an important link. Because with a number of them, either they have been coveting power for a while in some form, Theresa May, Gordon Brown. I don't necessarily think John Major was particularly, because I think he emerged as a bit of a dark horse kind of compromise candidate.
He wasn't Michael Heseltine.
But because they've been in positions of kind of coveting power for the most part, or being in a position where, in the case of Major, where it was at least feasible they could get there, they didn't necessarily have a plan, weirdly, about what they wanted to do when they acquired the power and became Prime Minister. And I think the lack of planning on that part is where you end up with a directionless government that can't get things done. Because when you look at Thatcher, when she first became Prime Minister, when you look at Blair, when he first became Prime Minister, they had clearly identifiable policy aims and an agenda they wanted to bring in.
And I think we can add to that as well the coalition government, in that they had to put together the coalition agreement, which was a plan for government, which basically they did stick to. Not that we want to drone on about voting systems for a little bit, but I suppose the thing with a proportional system like in Italy or Germany is it might take a while to get a government, but when you've got one, you have an agreed agenda that you stick to. Mm-hmm. And you don't tend to see a lot of rebellion in parties from that, because that agenda tends to be democratically passed through the system. Whereas in Britain, that wasn't there. And that directionless, certainly in the case of Brown and May, a lot of it seems to come from the fact that both of those two prime ministers tend to prioritise short-term tactical wins over long-term strategy. So Brown was very much of the initiativitis of New Labour. There was always some new policy every day. A lot of red meat for the right-wing tabloids as well.
Yep.
So Theresa May's doing it on Brexit, and a lot of the idiotic things that she's doing are to try and have a few easy wins on Brexit with the tabloids, hence trying to fix a date we're leaving the EU, hence this round now, I suspect. Whereas with Brown, a lot of the red meat for the tabloids was over immigration. It's over that rhetoric of British jobs for British workers. Gordon Brown did the interview with Mumsnet and was asked what his favourite biscuit was, and he wasn't able to give a straight answer. And it's just this feeling that he wasn't able to give an answer to a question because he's too busy thinking about what the political implications are, that he wasn't able to be bold.
Yeah, and I think that short-termism also actually, to a degree, applies to John Major, though for a different reason. Major's government was just constantly fighting fires after, you know, decades of Tory rule in the government. By virtue of being in power that long, everything that went wrong was their fault, and therefore they were having to deal with all of it. And he came in at the end of that period and was just having to deal with all of the fallout from that. Throw in some self-made catastrophes like the Black Wednesday and the ERM, and you have a constant battlefield of things that are just going wrong, which meant for Major, he couldn't necessarily focus that much on building in a long-term plan.
Another thing which I think is characterised of those three governments, and again it is because they are the back end of an administration that have been in power for quite a long time, is that you have cash for access scandals featuring former ministers. Related to that is the fact that the talent pool of ministers at the end of an administration is quite small. It's, the nice thick of it quote is, it's like season 10 of the Big Breakfast. So you started off with Chris Evans and Johnny Vaughan in season 1 or 2. But then, you know, by season 10, you end up with the tea lady coming out to present the show. You can definitely see that in a few of the ministerial appointments that Theresa May's had to do, in the fact that she cleared out people like Nicky Morgan, Anna Sabre, George Osborne, who, whatever you think of their politics, they're fairly competent people, whereas people like Chris Grayling are still there. What it also means is that former ministers who are on the back benches, they are often approached in sting operations and end up trying to sell expertise to the highest bidder. So There was one in the Sunday Times, I believe it was last week, where ex-ministers like Andrew Lansley were selling their expertise. Obviously, with the case of Andrew Lansley, we're using the word expertise to be a very wide definition here. But they're kind of selling their expertise over Brexit, essentially to the highest bidder. And I think there was a dispatches programme and there was a bit of a sting operation in a similar way to there was in the back end of the New Labour government, former ministers who were involved in a cash for lobbying affair. Also, it happens kind of cash for questions and all the sleaze stories in the Major administration. When I saw the Sunday Times story, I thought, okay, that is a sign that we have an administration. This isn't even just the Prime Minister. It's an administration that's tired. It's on its last legs. And now we have the sleaze story to
back it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those things where the lack of fresh talent across a political party after being in power for so many years means you end up being a bit desperate and you end up trying to move people around. And, you know, some people do get moved that deserve to be moved. Case in point, Andrew Lansley, when he was booted out from health and out of the government. But these are people who an awful lot of them will measure their success based on their salary, given that they're no longer in government. And when they look around at a number of their compatriots, especially on the Tory benches, I would imagine, you know, they're probably not necessarily earning as much as they used to. So that makes them feel a little bit more, I don't want to use the term manly, but, you know, it makes them feel a little bit less secure in who they are and in their own abilities and their self-confidence. Hawking themselves out like that is a nice way to earn, you know, earn some extra cash.
Mm. And I suppose it does sound silly when they are still on an MP salary, and an MP salary is pretty substantial amount of money. I mean, at the moment it's 74 grand a year, but if you were a cabinet minister and you're being paid, I think the going rate now is about 140 grand. If you suddenly take a 60 grand pay cut and you've got half your salary and you're measuring your salary by your friends who are earning more, then you can see why there is this need to want to try and get more cash but also try and prove yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think about these administrations that follow other governments, like following the Blair government or following the coalition government, is that those governments ended up having a hardcore of MPs who were quite rebellious. Philip Cowley's done some nice work on this. Apparently, under New Labour, there's a group of Labour MPs who voted against the government line on, I think it was 28%. Of the government division, so over a quarter. Now, obviously, that wasn't really a problem most of the time. It was generally a small fringe group, led by people like Jeremy Corbyn, Don McDonnell, John McDonnell, Diane Abbott as well, essentially a lot of the shadow
cabinet. It's the Labour campaign group, basically.
Mm. And obviously, there were much bigger rebellions over Iraq, over tuition fees.
90-day detention.
Mm. But you had these serial rebels, and I think Jeremy Corbyn, it's something like 14 million times he voted against New Labour or something. And the coalition is pretty similar. Now, actually, the MPs under the coalition, more rebellious. So that kind of core of rebellious MPs, people like Philip Davis, our old friend Peter Bone, our new nemesis Jacob Rees-Mogg, that group of Tory MPs voted against the government on divisions 35% of the time. Now, in the short term, that wasn't really a problem for those governments because Tony Blair was actually able to deliver a big majority in a general election. The coalition, because obviously you've got Tory and Lib Dem MPs together, they had enough votes to get their policies through. That group of rebellious MPs has led to quite big problems for the party in the longer run. So one of those serial rebels ends up being Labour leader. One of the reasons why Theresa May felt like she had to call an election is because she had a very small majority and did not think she could get the votes to pass through the legislation on Brexit that she needed to. And to be fair, she had a point. The problem was she made the problem worse for herself.
Yeah, there's that decision to hold that election is going to haunt Theresa May for the rest of her life, I feel.
Gordon Brown's premiership was never quite the same after that, after not calling the election as opposed to calling it. And it's interesting, it is the whole emperor has no clothes thing. At the start, there's a bit of an aura around a Prime Minister. But when the Prime Minister has lost that aura, it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to try and get it back.
Yeah, and I think that's actually where the fact that the May, Brown and Major all inherited their administrations to begin with, that also plays into that loss of the aura. Because at least if you've won an election, you've got a lot more political capital, basically, to spend internally when it comes to party politics. So you can actually bend those rebels to your will maybe a bit more effectively. If Theresa May had been able to return a great big stonking Tory landslide in 2017, chances are, you know, all the Brexiteers would be shutting up by now. If we were going to be moving towards, say, custom union membership, because there'd be a great big stonking number of Tory MPs who owed their job to Theresa May. And that sort of thing goes very, very far in terms of being able to get people on board for your agenda. But because she didn't do that and she lost seats, suddenly everybody's able to, you know, rise up against her on both sides of the debate.
The other contrast, and we have talked about it a little bit before, that idea that these governments, because they are the back end of governments, there's a lot of crises which they are basically having to firefight. Now, the contrast between May and Brown is that when the crisis happened, Gordon Brown's premiership, actually that saved him, in that he was the only one who had that big vision. And I think history will judge Gordon Brown relatively kinder than he was at the time, and probably seen now as being the person who organised that bailout, who organised the G7 and G20 to make sure they saved the world's financial system.
But again, just linking back, that was a reactive element. If you hadn't had that financial crash, what would Gordon Brown have done? Again, it's that lack of vision, that lack of clarity on the domestic front, more than anything, which leads to Gordon Brown being viewed negatively currently.
So. And with Major, obviously, after Black Wednesday, there's a lot of firefighting, but there's accomplishing a few more domestic things. I mean, again, I think there'll be, I've said on this podcast before, that I think there'll be a little bit of a historical revisionism of the Major administration, partly because historians are contrary bastards anyway, so someone's going to defend John Major. But I think it's also because he'll be seen in terms of being able to do stuff like privatise the railways, even though probably not a great idea, or introducing the national lottery, that kind of thing. And also the start of negotiating peace in Northern Ireland. It's those kind of things that someone can point to achievements that he did, as well as Maastricht as well, and passing the Maastricht Treaty. The 90s were quite a good time economically, certainly compared to a financial crash under Brown or now stagnated growth under May. Actually, the Major years were a time of prosperity for quite a few people.
Yeah.
The thing that Major and Brown had in common is, despite the fact that basically their MPs didn't think they were very good and there were lots of little plots to try and remove them, they stayed in post. Now, to go back to what you said earlier, obviously Major did win an election in 92, so he did have that five-year mandate to stay in position, even though his majority had been lost. And he did face a confidence vote, so he stood down and triggered a confidence vote, but stayed in there. Gordon Brown stayed in post as well, despite the fact there were a few plots to try and remove him. There was, I think, one abortive coup. I think it was
James Purnell resigned, the aim being that David Miliband would then also resign after the fact as well. Mm. And that was the aim being to then bring down Brown, except Miliband basically chickened out.
Yeah, Miliband bottled it, and then I think it was at Labour conference, and there's another one where he wrote an article for The Guardian, which was a thinly veiled leadership pitch,
yeah,
and then arrived at Labour conference holding a banana.
I'd forgotten about the banana.
British politics for the past decade has been defined by various Miliband brothers looking silly with food implements. Maybe if David Miliband had the bacon sandwich and Ed Miliband had the banana, we'd have had two Miliband prime ministers and we wouldn't be in this mess. But do you think, and again, I think my answer to this, a bit like the answer to what is my favourite Elvis Costello song, basically changes every day, but do you think there is a chance that Theresa May, like those two, will just stick it out until the next election? Or at least, are we measuring her premiership in years rather than weeks or months?
I really wish I had an answer to this, but because I could see it going either way. If the government is leaning currently towards more of a, you know, we're going going to have some form of customs union with the EU. I believe the current speculation is that it's going to be on manufactured goods, basically on the manufacturing front, so it will be for goods but not services, which kind of makes sense, actually, as a nice, as a reasonable compromise position. There isn't a single market in the EU for services. So, and really, the reality is that's probably not going to happen with us leaving anyway, because Britain was one of the leading countries pushing for that, because it's such a major part of our economy compared to, you know, Germany from France and Spain and Italy. So if we do go down that kind of route, then you could easily see the, a few more letters ending up at the 1922 committee chair's office and, you know, a vote of no confidence happening. And if that happens, she could go very, very quickly. But at the same time, the question of who replaces her still looms large. Now, there's an awful lot of talk about Jacob Rees-Mogg recently again. We did an entire episode of our Silly Season podcasts on why Mogmentum was ridiculous.
This Silly Season just got real, Steve.
I know. But to be honest, if Mogg is the answer for the Tories, then they are asking the wrong question in terms of being able to elect somebody who's going to win an election for them. He's far too divisive. His opinions are much too right-wing to win over the people that they're already losing. If they do choose someone like Mogg, they're going to lose the next election, or at least they're not going to win it. And as a result, they're screwed. There's still no one else, though, which means I could see Theresa May eking out, you know, a bit more time in post, because there is no one to take over that's probably acceptable to the majority of the party. There isn't an obvious compromise candidate.
But I think the interesting thing is that it's the Me Too dimension which is interesting for this one, because what would make most sense, really, if you were looking at it like a maths puzzle, is you'd say, okay, we're going to have a safe pair of hands. So, Damien Green, Michael Fallon, just do it for a bit. However, they can't do that because both of them are implicated in sexual in scandals, and they've had to resign in scandals. So, actually, there isn't really anyone who you could see as being a safe pair of hands to take them over into the short term who doesn't have wider ambitions. I mean, the nearest you've got is someone like Chris Grayling, and
oh God, no!
It can't happen. It can't. I mean, it might, and that'd be terrible. But
it can't.
It can't. There literally isn't really, unless they kind of bring back Ken Clark or Michael Heseltine. Actually, be much better, but.
I'm just trying to think of like some of the other potential people here. I mean, like Gavin Williamson, far too ambitious.
Far too rubbish.
Yeah, as well. But far too ambitious, far too rubbish.
Amber Rudd is far too Remain-y. Philip Hammond is
far too Remain-y and boring.
And has the political skills of a rabbit.
Hunt. I mean, I know I've previously talked about him on the podcast as being like one of the runners and riders to watch in terms of the cabinet ministers and members. He's been trying to reinvent himself as a born-again Brexiteer, so maybe he becomes that compromise candidate in some form. But, I mean, he's managed to survive at Health, which is not an easy breathe for the Tories.
The thing is, that is exactly the same thing as about Theresa May in the Home Office.
I know. I'm not saying it would end well for the country, but I'm saying I could see the Tories going for it.
I mean, you wrote a piece for the website this week suggesting that the best thing to do is just to make Michael Gove Prime Minister in your continuing quest to make everyone hate you.
It's true. Well, it's like, basically, whatever way the Brexit negotiations start to go, and whatever decisions that the government makes, you know, Theresa May is going to be in a very precarious position, and her leadership is going to become under threat. And the more precarious May's position gets, the more and more time we're going to lose, and as part of the negotiations, what the Tories need to do, that's for in terms of it being best for Britain, is to have a leader and a prime minister who's going to get stuff done. And, you know, you can dislike Michael Gove for multiple reasons. And, you know, I rabidly disagree with him on an awful lot of things.
Guilty as charged.
But the reason we dislike him, or he gets disliked a lot, is because he gets stuff done. And if he were to become in as Tory leader and as Prime Minister, yes, we may end up going towards a hard Brexit, but I think that's much more likely than not now anyway. but he'd actually be focused on getting us prepared for it rather than, you know, umming and ahhing or trying to fight a culture war, which was what Jacob Rees-Mogg might try and do at the same time. He would be task-oriented and just get on with the job. He's also probably the only person that might actually go in and go, right, I'm going to do this, job done, and then leave. Because it's the sort of thing where he wouldn't necessarily care too much about building a grand vision beyond that. I think he wants to just do stuff. And I think Brexit is a very good thing for him to be able to implement. So, yeah, I think we could do a lot worse than Gove as leader, given the alternatives. I just don't think he'd actually ever get onto the ballot.
I think shafting Boris last year or 2 years ago has done it in for him. And I can see him being kingmaker. I think whoever Gove endorses will get it, yeah. But I don't think Gove will get there.
And I think Gove probably ends up as chancellor under that person.
I mean, if we think about the point of the episode to think about historical parallels, the parallel with Brown, there was never, as Steve Richards wrote in his book on the Brown premiership, there wasn't really a point of principle that a prospective leader could ever disagree with and use as a basis for a leadership bid in the same way, say, with Thatcher, it was Geoffrey Howe resigning over Europe and what have you. With Brexit and May, there's a very clear point of principle. I can see actually what happened to John Major happening to Theresa May, in that I think there will be a vote of confidence. I imagine it will be this year. I think it's almost inevitable now.
It's just whether or not she can survive it. If she survives it, then she's set.
And I have a feeling that she might be able to survive it for the reasons that you've said, potentially. It depends, though, because on the other hand, she could easily just drift or make some other terrible decision or pick some other fight she can't win and just basically piss off enough people that actually they go, well, no. Like, to quote one of the anonymous Tory sources I heard this week, that maybe bad leadership might be better than no leadership. So next week, we'll probably have a podcast all about how we were wrong, and actually Theresa May's probably ended up resigning at this point, and we'll end up explaining why that happened. We will have reaction in the week on the website, notenoughchampagne.com. We'll have stuff on Twitter, which is @nochampagnepod, and we'll have stuff on Facebook as well, at facebook.com/, you guessed it, listeners, Not Enough Champagne. My personal Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter.
Mine is @centreradical.
James Cram is responsible for our logo, and Dave Deppert is responsible for our theme tune. Happy plotting, everyone. Apart from Gavin Williamson, just get better at it, please.